The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I thought today would be a good day for me not to give a talk, but rather to... I'd like to hear a little bit from you, what's on your mind and the kind of questions you might have about meditation practice or Buddhist practice. And then I can try to respond to you. And it's sometimes better that way, because otherwise I'm just guessing it's what's useful to talk about. So, I'm back there behind.
That's perfect, because it just so happens that I had a simple question. But I noticed there was a lot of noise outside today, and I happened to be not feeling very well. So I was wondering what you advise about noise. I mean, is it okay to like wear, because I have these headphones, the noise reduction headphones that you can wear to keep it quiet. If you have like an illness and it makes it harder to concentrate sometimes.
Sure.
Is that okay to use that kind of meditation aid?
Well, the answer to most questions in this kind of scene here is that if it's helpful, then it's okay. If it's not helpful, then it's not okay. And so then to unpack a little bit that, I mean, that's kind of the basic idea rather than me saying, you know, yes or no or something. But the idea is that we have to kind of be very respectful and take into account our condition of our mind, our physical condition, whatever's going on. And then know how, and taking that into account, being mindful, being clear about what's going on here, have some sense of what the effect is going to be when we do different things. And so it could be that if someone is... really sensitive to drafts, then they should not sit under in a breeze, and they should go sit someplace else because they don't get sick. Someone else doesn't affect them at all. It's nice to sit in the breeze because it cools them down on a hot day. So two different people might be affected differently, and so you can't have a generic idea about what to do about sitting in a breeze. So about using some kind of device to help us in our meditation, like a hearing aid, you know, plugging up the ears or something. There are people who have a variety of reasons are very sensitive to sounds, hypersensitive, and so it's actually very painful. Sounds which are for normal people, not normal. I don't know, I shouldn't use the word normal, but since we don't know what that is, those two people in the world who are normal. But the it's quite difficult for some people, and so sometimes I see it in my kids' schools that there are kids who have a variety of sensitivities around sound, and they're going to a variety. Kids have to go do a variety of kind of auditory trainings to help them manage with that, so that the class is manageable for them. So if the effect of sound is detrimental to someone, makes them more agitated or spin out or something, then it might be useful to use some kind of something to block the ears. However, the most general generic approach in mindfulness practice is we want to take a natural way of being in the world without any props or any supports or anything, and just simply sit down and start paying attention to what's happening for us in that kind of state, that kind of condition. So unsupported, unpropped, unaided presence. What's that like for you? And then what's that like is that sometimes it's very difficult to be present. And then we face that directly, as opposed to saying, oh, I'm getting so distracted by all these things. I think, you know, if I listen to meditation music, I know I'll get really calm. Maybe you will get calm. But the disadvantage of that approach is you're not facing yourself. You're using a prop or an aid to get calm, as opposed to looking carefully at yourself at what makes you agitated, what keeps you distracted, And then working with that and finding the key to how to let go of it or how to settle it or deal with it. And in the long term, we're much better off kind of just being present in an ordinary way and then facing, dealing with what's here. So if there is a lot of sounds outside that make someone agitated, difficult, for example, then there has to be very careful analysis looking at that and deciding, well, I am getting agitated here, and making you kind of spin a little bit. What is most useful for me in the long term? In the long term, am I better facing it and being uncomfortable for a while and facing and dealing with it? Or am I better plugging it up the ears or having a noise reduction thing? And then I can meditate and look more, you know, clearly at what's going on. And so that's a kind of a judgment call that a meditator needs to make. And your example is true for, I mean, can be applied to many other things as well in meditation. You know, should I go to a really, really quiet place to meditate? Or should I just meditate, you know, in my home where the train goes by and the noise and the neighbors and the dogs and everything? And you know, if it's really, if it keeps you distracted over and over again and keeps you from looking and being present, maybe you want to go someplace where it's quiet to meditate. But there's something very powerful about just, this is my home, I have to be where I happen to be. So let me just sit here and learn what it's like to be present and calm and equanimous in this kind of busy environment. When I was first being introduced to this practice in Thailand, I went to visit a monk in a large monastery in Bangkok. And it was a very, very large monastery. And one of the headquarter monasteries in Thailand, it's called, what was it called? And the headquarters of the Mahani Thai sect. And so they had these big kind of dormitory kind of buildings where a lot of the monks stayed. And we, so the monk I was going to visit was up on the second or third floor. But you come into the building, and there's this kind of lobby. And the lobby, my guess is, was probably smaller than this room here. Or maybe about this long as this distance here, but maybe narrower. And near the entrance was a big desk and a telephone and receptionist. And people were constantly calling and asking someone, and the receptionist would pass the phone on to someone else or send someone up to get someone. Or people were, and it was a big building, so a lot of people, monks and visitors, were streaming in and out of this lobby. It was a lobby, right? You can imagine. Well, on one end of the lobby, there were steps going up, and so most people have to take the steps to go upstairs. They'd go up. And then just next to the steps, at the bottom of the lobby, there, that third of the lobby or so, was the meditation hall. And there were a dozen or 15 people sitting there meditating, while the phone was ringing and people were yelling, "Hey, it's the telephone's for you," or "I'm here to see so-and-so," and they're running up and down the steps by them, and they're just sitting there. And that was where they're doing their training. And they were sitting, some of the people I could see when I went in and out, they were sitting very still, very quiet. It was really rare, or maybe unknown, for me at least personally, to find a quiet, peaceful meditation center in Burma or in Thailand. The corner of Hopkins and Birch is quantumly quieter than most meditation centers in Thailand. They have one of the common sounds is really, really scratchy, poor quality speaker system in the village next door, blasting the local music. You know. So like in Burma, you know, I had to listen to Madonna sing "Just Like a Virgin." You know, I don't know how many times, over and over. The only it wasn't actually Madonna because it was her song, but it was sung in Burmese. So that was okay. And but you know how many all these songs, and then at some point the music stopped, like for a week or 7 days or longer. I forget. It was maybe a month. I forget. It's a long time. The music stopped because it became like special kind of Buddhist holy time, spiritual holy days, and so it was such, you know, the music stopped. But in place of the music, those loudspeakers, they 24 hours a day, the monks would chant in Pali, a language that no one really knew, chant Abhidharma texts. And Abhidharma texts are the most boring Buddhist texts you could possibly imagine, even if you understood it. And they were chanting it, you know, sitting and meditating. Or then there was a time when I sat in a monastery in Thailand, and an abbot. It was kind of a new place, and there were little, not meditation huts exactly, but little meditation development homes. It was like little. It was very modern, very orderly, and it had kind of like pseudo marble granite floors and big wooden doors, and looked like one room developed. You know, it was like one room townhouse, very small little place, and. And I was saying, oh, you go over there to that one building over there, that one room, little, nice place. And that's your place. And it's empty with nothing in it, except a bed. And this floor and a little mat to sit on. And it was right up against the edge of the monastery. And there was a kind of a fence, maybe a foot away from the back wall of this little hut I was in. So that was nice. And there was a farmer's field on the other side of that fence. So I was sitting there minding my business, and then I hear this engine going. And slowly this engine gets louder and louder and louder and louder. And it's a big tractor or some kind of line-moving machine that's building a trench right in the farmer's field right next to that fence. So, and when I got closer, my whole one-room townhouse was shaking. And I was sitting there, and it was really hot, so I'm dripping, and I get up, and I was all soaked and wet, just shaking. just doing my best, and then it could then slowly it went further down, and it got quieter and quieter. So that was interesting. And then on top of that, during that retreat, I remember, month-long retreat, I got constipated. Just sitting there, trying to deal with that. And then I finally went to town to ask for some kind of laxative. But I didn't speak Thai, and they didn't speak English. And trying to explain to pharmacists. What I wanted didn't work. So I gave up. So the point being that, for most of us, the sounds here, are good training, good practice. But if there is a health concern or reason, it's fine to have you do something. Yes?
How do you recommend working with tinnitus on the same?
Working with what?
Tinnitus, severe tinnitus.
Oh, tinnitus.
Okay.
Oh,
and the same kind of, in a little different vein. It's like when I read the chant, all conditioned things are arising and passing away. Understand
deeply.
And I say, except tinnitus.
Yeah, I know this for myself as well. I have a little bit of it. And on one retreat I sat, it became a real problem for me. Really loud, ringing, intense.
I've asked Steve Armstrong, I've asked a lot of teachers, what they recommend, because it's the most predominant thing. It's beyond breath. It's just always there. So sometimes I work with it just sound arising. But it's until another thought form or something, something kind of, I get distracted. It's not always there, but it is. So I just wanted to hear what your thoughts were. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a variety of ways of working with that. And I think many times the most useful one with that particular thing is to ignore it. Do your best to ignore it. And it's hard, but certainly you don't want to focus on it. And sometimes I think that when it's most problematic, it's somehow the mind has kind of locked onto it. And somehow, who knows why it's locked on, but somehow the mind is concerned with it or worried about it or something. And so sometimes with that particular phenomenon, I think it's often just best to ignore it. But another way to work with it is just allow it to be there and then study all the ways in which we are disturbed by it, bothered by it. And you can learn a lot about your tendencies to to react, to respond, to feel irritated or angry or afraid, or all that reactivity. In fact, any difficulty that you're dealing with meditation is often considered to be useful because the ways in which we react to it are often ways we react to other difficulties in other parts of our life. So if you learn how to really face this particular difficulty in our reactivity and understand it well, then you probably understand yourself better in other situations as well. So you might look at that for a while. In theory, I imagine that someone could just focus on and get really concentrated. I've never known anyone to do that. There is some people who teach listening meditation. Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Sumedho do that. And they claim it's a different frequency. I don't know what they're tuning into. But there is a constant frequency. And they say it's very useful and very helpful to get concentrated. So maybe the tinnitus is, you know, you could do that as well, but I don't know anything about that. So the two things that I think that as a general, see, in mindfulness we train ourselves to pay attention to everything, but the two things that are often useful to ignore that I think is the ringing in the ears, and the other is the heartbeat. My teacher in Burma said, forget about the heartbeat, just let, because you don't want it to feel like you're interfering with it or doing anything special with it. Just ignore it. That's what he said. And I kind of mostly go along with that. Sometimes it's interesting. It's fascinating sometimes, the heartbeat and the breath and the coordination and what goes on. But probably best is not to be play games like that and just... Yeah, please. Back there.
I have three questions. They're sort of, one is high level. What did the Buddha say about, if anything, about the existence of a supernatural being? And is there such a thing as, when we say the religion is the world, sometimes people say Buddhism is religion.
Yeah.
But it's probably not as organized as, say, Catholicism. So is there such a thing, position or view of supernatural being? And the last question is, one of my biggest sadnesses is the multiplicity of religions in the world and the evils. Are there Buddhist activities, that proactive activities for harmonizing religions in the world today?
Good question. And why are, especially the first two questions about supernatural beings, why is that important for you? Important enough that you want to ask a question?
It's important for me I think it's important for me. I have an analytical mind, and I know that everyone in the world is seeking the truth, and it's puzzling and disconcerting for me that there are so many religions, many views of the supernatural or not supernatural or whatever. And I guess it's important for me in my curiosity and my seeking the truth.
Yeah, what do we do with a tremendous diversity of teachings, but this is the truth? And when you have so many of them, it seems some of them are contradictory. You don't, you know, if one is true, the other one can't be, it seems to me. So what do we do? And when there's, 32,000 that say that they're true, do we accept all 32,000 as being true, or do we choose one to be true, and on what basis do we choose to be true, what authority? This kind of issue was faced at the time of the Buddha as well, and it was a pluralistic society with a lot of different beliefs, and he had to kind of respond or deal with all this as well. And the Buddha was very keen on questioning the authority upon which people believed something. There was something believed because it was in texts, because it was in books, it was a comparable thing back then. Oh, this is it's in my text, therefore it must be true. Or is it true because my teachers say it's true? Is it true because it's part of my culture or conditioning, my society, to believe it's true? Is it belief based on logic? You know, it's logical. Seems logical. I mean, that, you know, or is based on reasoning. What are the criteria? And he wanted people to look at that and really see. And the Buddha actually said that it's not necessarily true. Things that are believed on faith may or may not be true. Things that are reasoned out may or may not be true. Things that are taken to be true because your teachers or your books say they're true may or may not be true. So in other words, books, tradition, teachers, reason, logic, the general customs of society around, all those are not reliable for knowing what is true. And so it becomes very challenging, I think, for most religious people, if they're asked, why do you believe what you do? Upon what authority? And in some ways, for a lot of people, I think, if they realize the shakiness upon which they have, the shaky authority upon which they have their beliefs, then it gets kind of a little dicey about how do you relate to those beliefs and what's that. So the Buddha then would like to point that out. And with, you know, is that harmonizing with other religions? I like to think that it's very conducive to world peace if we begin questioning some of the underlying hard beliefs that people hold on to and then fight because of heaven. So it's kind of like putting a mirror up and saying, look more deeply, understand what's going on here. And then the Buddha said, well, what can you believe? What can you know? He wasn't so much interested in what you can believe, but what can you know as being true? And he said a variety of things. One thing he said was that, an interesting thing, he said, you preserve the truth, you safeguard the truth. When you believe something, you say, this is my belief. You don't say, you know, you don't say that there's a heaven. You say, my scriptures tell me there's a heaven. I have it, it's my faith that there's a heaven. It's my belief there's a heaven. If you contextualize what you say that kind of way, then you're safeguarding the truth. You're saying a true statement. It's a belief. It's a faith. You know, you're kind of telling people what the assumptions are based on. So that's how you safeguard the truth. But then the Buddha said you discover and become the truth through a series of practices, through looking very deeply. First of all, you have to settle the mind, live a clean enough life that the mind and heart can be clear and clean, so it becomes a useful instrument to see what's going on here. So you can see beyond, certainly you can see why you believe what you believe, and perhaps put that aside, your beliefs, in order to look and see directly for yourself, what is actually going on here? And then, but in order to do that really well, the Buddha said you need to get really stable, really still in the mind. And then look, you want to look very, very carefully. And when you look really, really deeply, you want to be able to see the workings of the mind in relationship to clinging and not clinging. The workings of the mind and how all the variations of greed, hate, and delusion operate. And as the mind gets really still and peaceful and a sense of well-being arises, it's possible to see these forces in the mind with greater and greater subtlety. And at some point, these forces of greed and delusion can be uprooted, can be let go of. And then a person experiences a level of peace and well-being that they know for themselves, oh, this is possible. It's possible to be free of these things. And then the idea of liberation is not a belief, but is something a person knows for themselves. They've witnessed it, they've experienced it for themselves. So the Buddha was very interested in questioning the beliefs people had and then offering them a series of practices so you become your own discoverer of the truth through your own experience. And the truth that he was pointing to was not the truth about supernatural beings, but rather the truth of what is it that liberates you. So what he was most interested was narrower in scope than what most religions are about. And so it's possible that maybe Buddhism shouldn't be considered a religion because of its narrower scope. And in fact, I was told that in Soviet Union times, Buddhism announced that it was not a religion because it was better in communist times not to be a religion. And here in America, we are happily a religion because it's all kinds of tax benefits. And so, you know, Buddhism is very flexible that way. You know, it doesn't really matter that much. And so, is Buddhism a religion among religions? I like to think of it that it is, because it has a view that's all encompassing. It has an approach that has an approach to life that affects our whole being, our whole way we live, and the whole way we live in relationship to the world itself. And that sense of totality and completion, there's no other higher value. It's like living from the highest value is what religions are about. So then how do we relate to other religions where they have these kinds of beliefs and all these different things? And that's a difficult question of how to relate. But I think that the Buddhist approach to religions, as to anything at all, is to, a starting point is always to look at oneself and see, are the forces of violence, forces of hate, forces of disrespect and these things in me? And can I uproot them in myself? And so then when we meet other people of other religions, we're not going to meet them with those qualities and those characteristics. And hopefully I can meet them with greater respect and understanding. It's a big topic. And also it's a difficult topic because even within, one religion, what is verbalized as being the belief, verbalized as being the teaching, can be interpreted in different ways. And so it's very hard when someone talks about a God, that they believe in God. And then someone else says, well, I believe in God too, we're partners, you know. And then they start explaining what they mean by God, and they're like, you know, light years apart. You know, so it's kind of hard to understand what people are pointing to, and so it's helpful to to ask more questions and learn what's going on before we disagree. But what's most interesting, I think, in terms of interreligious dialogue, interfaith dialogue or contact, is not the differences between what people believe, but between what people practice. And many times there's a lot more commonality among people when they focus on what they're practicing with and what they believe. There's a monk named Brother David Stendelrust, and he said that he feels he spent years in Catholic monasteries, and he says that he feels he has more in common with Buddhist monks. He feels he has more in common with Buddhist monks than he does with most lay Christians, because they share a lifestyle, they share a practice, and so much of the same changes and transformations and experiences happen in that kind of monastic lifestyle and meditation and prayer. Then, you know, that gives them a lot of common ground. Even though maybe they can't meet at the theological level, they can meet at the heart level around the practices and all that. So that was not a thought out answer. So hopefully I covered enough bases and I managed to avoid the supernatural question. I saw someone right here before who was just before. Yes.
About a year ago, I went through a phase in my meditation where I would start rocking, and the mention about the heartbeat reminded me of this. It seemed like the rocking was connected about the same rate as my heart rate, or it skipped a beat or something like that. And it was very interesting because I mentioned, I went up to you after class one night and talked to you about this, and your response was to think about what is going on right before it starts. And right after you said that to me, the rocking stopped. And it brought up, it was very fascinating how this, I thought this thing was just completely unconscious, and I had it just, you know, developed. I'd never heard of it or thought of it or anything. And then it was just very curious to me that as soon as I talked about it with you, oh, it's gone. And I just thought maybe you could.
Well, it's an interesting topic, movement in meditation. And there's a variety of kinds of movements that some people occasionally will have, kind of a rocking or that happens when a beat is one. I get it sometimes, but generally I doubt anybody can see it unless I'm falling asleep. Then, but you know, it just feels very, very subtle, and my body is so still that the heartbeat kind of is resonating through the body a little bit. And I don't know sometimes what it's about. When it's really subtle. But I felt it sometimes. But sometimes movement can be bigger, and sometimes the rocking can be bigger, sometimes it can be seen. It might have genesis in the heartbeat, for example, but it might be other things going along to kind of amplify it. And sometimes there are sudden jerks that can happen. Some people have it when they fall asleep, you know, some release or something. And that can happen in meditation as well. When I was in the monastery a few times, I remember sometimes both my arms going out like that, then suddenly no control. And luckily that, you know, the people are far enough away. And once I think both my legs and hands went at the same time, almost popped right up. And then there's sometimes there can be movements that his arm suddenly feels like it wants to move or something. A variety of things can happen. You know, the body starts rocking, kind of bigger sways or movement. And different things can happen. And why is this happening? Sometimes maybe it's a release, something's being purified, something's working itself out, something's going on. But what's very interesting, so there's a number of questions or investigations that, are useful to do when there's any kind of movement in meditation. One of them is there any kind of interest in it or curiosity? Any kind of interest or curiosity in it, because even mild interest, sometimes that's the amplifier, or that's what keeps it going. Recently someone told me that she was doing a lot of movement. She did a long retreat. She's doing a lot of movement, and I asked her. It's still quieter here than in Asia. I asked her to look and see, you know, is there any interest in it? And she said, Ramdas has a story of having a meditation group on top of, in New York City, I think, on top of a fire department, you know, upstairs. And so every once in a while they're sitting meditating and the fires start going and the building would shake. And at first people were disturbed by it, but after a while they kind of got into the energy. Back to the movement. So I talked to her about, you know, are you interested? And she said, no, I'm not interested, just something that's happening. And then some months later, she came back to me a little bit, slightly embarrassed, maybe, saying, you know, it turned out I was really fascinated by it. And it was the fascination that was keeping the movement going. You know, she was kind of indulging in it a little bit, and that was the very cause. Sometimes asking, what's your relationship to it is interesting, really looking. Because sometimes with movement, people are being comforted by it. Especially rocking. Oh, this looks good. And the comforting might be very subtle, but it's comforting what's going on. Sometimes there's a variety of things been going on. Sometimes we have a relationship to the phenomena, and so we have to find out what that relationship is, because that's what's keeping it going. That's one thing. The other thing with interesting is the question I asked you, the investigation I point to you two. What's going on, what's happening? And some kinds of movements, not all, but some kind of movements in meditation, there might be something emotional or some idea or some kind of fear or something that they've just for a fraction of a moment before, and it's in response to that emotion or belief or value or thought or memory or something that the body begins to suddenly do something. And so if you can find the beginning point that happens just before and recognize that, sometimes you can start recognizing it when it arises, and it doesn't have to translate into movement. Just be mindful right there for that fear or that thing that's going on. And sometimes the movement in meditation is just something that has to work itself out over time. You know? And some people don't like it particularly. You know, it's not like they're interested or fascinated or want it to happen. You know, some people will start moving kind of all kinds of creative ways and they feel, oh, this is really spiritual. And, you know, that's kind of like validating it, and that's where people are going. But sometimes it's just, who knows what's going on? Release of energy, release of something that needs to come out. And so sometimes there's movement that happens that just has to play itself out. And generally, you know, everything's impermanent, passes in its own time. Okay? You asked a question yesterday. So I want to see if anybody else has a chance. And you come up afterwards and ask me when it's over. Is it okay? Because I want to give new people chances. Yeah?
Question tonight is about how to work with irritability.
Irritability?
Yes. I had a conversation with my sister who I hardly ever speak to. And I found myself having a moment of irritability. And then there was, it wasn't something I wanted to do. And so there was some guilt about it. And sort of, you know, how to deal with this emotion?
It's great. It's a good question. I appreciate it. It's a good question. I appreciate the concern. And I want to ask you in return, irritability in the scale of things, in my mind, irritability is a relatively mild version of anger or something like that. And so if that's true, that's relatively mild, why is there enough charge around it if you bring that up as an issue with you? I'm not saying, you know, it's fine, it's great that you brought it up, but I just wanted to understand it better, what's behind it for you.
I think that happens to me often enough, and around perhaps people that I love.
Mm.
You know, and I think that there is a fear of, there is this particular dislike or fear of hurting people.
So behind your irritability is a fear of hurting people.
Yeah.
So you're partly irritated about toward yourself then?
I feel bad. This happens, and this irritability happens. And then there is this idea of them feeling bad about
because
myself.
You're afraid that in the irritated state you might say something that hurts them.
Yes, yes.
So you want to kind of protect everyone in concern and not let your irritability get the upper hand. You don't want to act from your irritability.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. And you know, some of the more difficult places to understand ourselves and to work with these kinds of things is in family situations. The bonding, the deep psychological connections we have are so deep that sometimes it's harder to kind of grapple and deal with our emotional life in those settings than anywhere else. But, you know, I think that what would be useful if you could is to sit down and next time you have a good irritable opportunity is go find, if you can, go find some place quiet where you can go sit down and be quiet and sit with your irritability. And really kind of begin investigating it carefully. What is going on here for you? And use all the skills of mindfulness with it. So the first thing to do is give it permission to be there. And explore whether you can really allow it to be there or whether there is some kind of pushing it away or some kind of self-criticism or some kind of belief in relationship to it. Or how simple can you be in relationship to it? Can you just allow it to be there as if it has permission to be there? And if you can't, explore that. What's going on for you? Once you can get close to just allowing it to be there by itself, as permission to be there, then you want to make more space for it to understand better what's there. Perhaps it needs to be given more freedom. Maybe the irritability needs to kind of bubble up and become more anger. Maybe that's, you give more freedom, and maybe if you go in a quiet place, you can give it its freedom to get stronger if that's what it needs to do. Or perhaps you can begin looking and seeing what are some of the other feelings, emotions, that arise connected to the irritability. Before you get irritated, the same question as movement, just before you get irritated, what happens to you? So look back. What happened just before I got irritated? What was it about the conversation we were having that bothered me enough that I got irritated? What did I get hurt? Did I get afraid? Did I get annoyed? Do I feel frustrated? Am I remembering past slights and past hurts? You know, what would happen just before I got irritated is interesting to look at. What are the other feelings and emotions connected to it? What are some of the beliefs that are operating in relationship to it? And what are some of the beliefs about yourself? What are some of your beliefs about what it means to be in relationship to your family or your sister or something like that? So it helps to get really quiet. So to allow yourself to be irritated and then take your time to explore this whole inner world. And as you get a greater understanding of it, you start teasing apart the different elements, you might find that you're less under its control. And you might find the place where you can let go of it. But you can't let go of it until you understand it well. So that's what I recommend. That understandable? Not necessarily pleasant. But it's a very mature, responsible thing to do, is to stop and really try to understand deeply. And that kind of work sometimes is greatly supported by talking to other people about it, finding a really good friend and say, you know, I have this thing that goes on with my sister. And can we just kind of go for a walk and just, can I tell you the story, or can you ask me questions about it? And kind of bounce off someone, other people sometimes can help kind of open up new perspectives as well. So you're not just doing it alone. Okay, well, that was very nice. I hope it was nice for all of you too. I appreciated very much the questions and getting a chance to hear from you and your concerns and all that. And sometimes I feel we don't do this enough, this approach. And thank you, and I wish you well.